Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Is there you go.
Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank
really
you.
Great job there, Drew.
That's my co-host who is subbing for Paul Strohle, which is what I was starting to explain. Paul is on an extended time period back east visiting family members in Chicago, and also will be going on to Connecticut and will be back with us in January. But in his place, we have the wonderful actor, and he who's mastered the board here.
Obviously. Paul told me to make him look good. I'm just doing my part here, Michael.
This is Andrew David James, who was you were just listening to there. Welcome back, Andrew, for
Thank
your
you.
Second show.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. So let's thank our sponsors and get that out of the way right now. We'd like to thank, ladies and gentlemen, our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge the PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to PerformingArtsLive.com for lending their support to our live arts calendar, Performing Arts Live.
Yeah, Andrew, and as you know, we've got three guests with us today. Editor and live arts critic for BroadwayWorld.com, who is also an author with a delightful new children's holiday book to talk about, along with his lovely and oh-so-talented illustrator, Lori Morgan, via telephone. She'll be calling us in just a couple of minutes. And as if that isn't enough, a good friend of State of the Arts, Hoyt Richards, is back, the fashion business's first ever male supermodel, who is also a successful producer, screenwriter, and actor, enjoying a very, very award-winning year this year. But first, Andrew, let me ask you, how was your week?
Good. Thank you. We have a wealth of riches in the studio today.
We do.
I was going to be the world's first supermodel.
You were.
But I decided to go into acting instead. I thought that was a smarter, more lucrative decision.
You never know.
I had a good week, Michael. Thank you for asking. I've got two sick youngins at home. So I've got a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old who are sick as dogs and hanging around the house.
Really?
Yeah, it makes work hard because, you know, we've been going all over the place and I'm trying to keep them healthy. But I did have time to stalk the internet to find our dear Paul and watch Straight Up with a Twist. Have you seen this?
Oh, yeah, yes, I handled it.
I tell you, that was just absolutely amazing. A total blast to watch. And what a portrait of Paul, who is just a character in his own right. So.
Playing every member of his family.
Very, very.
And very well.
Extremely well, you're absolutely right. So that was a blast. I had a good time doing that. Yeah.
Good for you. And you're also rehearsing a show that you're going to be in, the Christmas
Carol. Indeed, Christmas Carol. I was sitting with Ed Hall, who, of course, was on The Tonight Show, and I told him I was going to do the radio, and he said, radio. And then I started thinking about Ed's career. You know, Ed had that great sign off. He always said, and me, I'm Ed Hall. So I'm going to work on something for the show, and I'm going to come up with something really good to embarrass Ed Hall with before the end of it. I'm going to have a great sign off by the end of the show.
Oh, good.
I think an hour is long enough to come up with that.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, a Christmas Carol that you're doing runs December 10th through the 13th at the beautiful Thousand Oaks Civic Arts Plaza, and that's just off the 101 Freeway in Thousand Oaks, and a beautiful, beautiful Performing Arts Center there. Tickets can be purchased through Ticketmaster or by calling the Thousand Oaks Civic Arts Plaza box office at 805-449-2787. And you are playing Bob Cratchit.
I am. Ed Hall is Scrooge. I'm Bob Cratchit. We have Kelly Christofferson, who's playing Belle, and some amazing, amazing talents. Richard Winterstein and some really great people. Alan Hunt is playing the narrator, and just an endearing.
He's not related to Helen Hunt, is he?
No, although Marcia Hunt, who is an amazing.
Oh,
she's not,
she's a wonderful actress.
Exactly. Yeah. And she's 98 now.
Wow.
And she's got a wonderful, wonderful documentary coming out on the Blacklist and her time with HUAC and being blacklisted in Hollywood. And she's got that coming out. It's called Sweet Adversity. It's going to be amazing.
Hmm.
So, yeah, keep an eye out for that.
I asked that about Helen Hunt because when I was a young tour guide at Universal Studios, there used to be a what they called the upper lot, which is still the upper lot, but there was a joke at one of the places that tourists would go on, and it was the stunt show. Did you ever see that?
No.
Ever go up to Universal Hawaii?
Yeah, I've been there, of course.
So this person would say...
It's a requirement being in the city, right?
There would be a host, and they would introduce the stars, and then the show would go on. The host always said, we had a purse left behind on the previous show, ladies and gentlemen, and... If anybody belongs to... Oh, you know what? I've just screwed up the whole joke. I did. So the punchline
is... your first time,
to
Michael.
To go to hell and hunt for it.
How great.
I'm so embarrassed. I cannot tell the joke.
If only this wasn't live radio.
I know, yeah, right?
This is why we rehearse, Michael. Yeah. This is the reason. Stage plays only for here on out for me.
Yeah, can't do it.
I tell you, so was Helen Hunt there? Was she?
She had some connection because it was hilarious, you know, when he said it. He said, go to Helen Hunt for it.
The frightening part is there's some woman who's still looking for that person, looking for Helen Hunt, too.
Probably. I actually told the joke to Helen Hunt. I interviewed her at the Hollywood Bowl on opening night of one of their seasons recently. She did not laugh. I think because I didn't tell it the right way.
No, it's probably her sense of humor, because I know you're very, very funny. So I think...
Oh, you do?
I'm going to put it out there right now. Helen's not here. She can't yell at me. So our first guest says that painting became a true love after years in the entertainment field. Well-traveled, she is intrigued by historical architecture, and most of her work contains part of a house, a castle, a cottage, a cabin, a barn, or other structure. Many of her paintings have windows or doors and arches and pathways. She's also fascinated by man's use of natural substances such as stone, brick, wood, and often adds those to her work as well. She creates in both a wet and dry medium and is an award winner whose art has been exhibited by galleries, including the Gallery of Santa Clarita, Lonnie Chapman Theater, Jet Studios, Siegel Fine Art, the Canyon Theater Guild, Repertory East Playhouse, Santa Clarita City Hall, the Valley Fair, and other art fairs and shows throughout L.A. County. She's with us via telephone today, we hope. We've had all kinds of technical problems. And here she is. We welcome our dear and much lauded Miss Laurie Morgan. Laurie, are you there? Hi, Laurie. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I absolutely can. It's wonderful to meet you over the phone.
Hi, Don.
I'm Greg Ware, and we have another guest in the studio, Laurie, Mr. Hoyt Richards.
Hello, Laurie.
Hello, Mr. Richards.
And I'm just looking at your lovely face and sitting in front of a piece of work that you're doing on something there, which is a part of your bio.
Yeah, I like that picture.
Yeah, it's very sweet. Very nice. So tell us, Laurie, first of all, you got interested in this. How old were you? You say painting became a true love after years in the entertainment field.
This is true. When I was a little girl, I knew I had some aptitude for art, but I didn't apply it because my mother was such an amazing visual artist. So I went the other direction, went into music, singing, acting, and I did that for many, many years. And one day I bid on a silent auction item about 15 years ago for a month's art class, and I won it. I took the class, and I went, oh my goodness, I'm much better than I thought I was. And I just took off from there.
That's a nice thing to find out, Laurie.
Yeah.
My name's Andrew James. It's nice to meet you over the phone. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Andrew James.
Good. I'm sitting here looking at this beautiful picture on the cover of Dawn's book, which is absolutely amazing. Is that an oak tree there?
It is his description of the holy oak tree.
It's absolutely beautiful, and the book's charming as well. Now, how long have you known Dawn?
Probably close to 10 years, I believe. We met in theater, and he's an owner of several of my paintings,
yes.
So it was...
Free hang on my wall.
Yeah, so it was fun to be able to do this project for him.
Now, Laurie, I saw you did some portraiture as well, I think, but do you also normally paint in landscape, is that correct?
It depends on what medium I'm in, but the commissions that I do are usually portraits. I don't choose to do portraits on my own necessarily, although I have done my dogs. But I like landscape
very well.
With different medium.
And Laurie, is that generally painted in plein air, or do you do it in studio?
I like studio better because I like to change my mind a lot.
Laurie, when you do a portrait of an animal, do you take a photo of it first and then do it from the photo, or how do you work?
I take a photo, but I like several different photos so that I can get different angles, you know, picture it more in a 3D mm-hmm. aspect so that I can get more of the character of the animal.
So for me to commission you to do a painting of me, which would be classic because I have two beagles.
There's going to be a lot of fees added here. She's going to do paintings for
right.
you, Michael.
I'd have to be in a red riding suit and
very nice.
The beagles at my feet.
The fox hunter.
Yes. And how much would that cost? A lot of money? Am I in the barking up the wrong tree here or what?
Well, it would depend first on what size you want it to be and then what medium. If it was an oil painting, I'd charge you a lot because I don't like painting in oil.
Oh, you don't. What is your preference?
If you wanted it in acrylic or pastels, then probably it would be less.
Oh, well, we'll have to talk about that.
Now, yeah, we'll talk.
Lori, how much would it be to paint Michael as a beagle? That's what I want to know, because we're going to hang that up here in the studio and put it up on the wall, right. And I think we have some little inspiration to work
right.
with.
Right.
Michael as a beagle. Now, that I would give you quite a discount for that one.
We're going to get together on this, girl. I can feel it right now, I'm telling you. And Lori, generally, size speaking, are you painting in a larger scale, 30 by 40, or does it tend to be a little bit smaller than that?
Well, since I do sell my paintings, and I mostly sell them framed, I prefer to do it smaller so that I don't have to charge that much once I have it, the cost of framing something. So the bigger it is, the more I have to charge you.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer to keep it under 16 by 20.
So as
that's
always,
a good size,
size
huh?
matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Size does matter in this one.
Yes, I wouldn't touch that otherwise. But
that's been said before.
So, Lori, also with Don's wonderful book, and that's, of course, where you got the inspiration to paint all of the lovely renderings in the book. But
yeah.
Is there a certain process? How do you? What if you find yourself not connecting to some part of it that requires an image? Do you discuss that with the author, in this case being Don, or would you discuss it with the author?
Well, it started off, of course, me reading the book.
Right.
And I read it several times, and there were certain areas where he had such vivid visual images of particular places, things, or the characters, that it made me want to see them. That's what I chose to...
Yeah.
That's what I decided to paint. And we discussed it. He had a couple other things in mind, and I really convinced him that these were the pictures that needed to be in his book, and he deferred to me. I thought that was very kind.
She had some marvelous ideas, and when she told me about them, I went, yes, why didn't I think of that? And so I knew that I had the right person working with me. I really did. You know.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak to us, and I'm sure that...
She also has some lovely prints, Michael,
yes?
that are available.
Oh,
you
nice.
Know, yeah.
Do you have a website, Lori?
I do. It's lorimorgan.biz.
.biz. Remember that, folks. If you're looking for something perhaps special for Christmas, maybe there would be some time to have something actually painted by her. But I'm sure you probably have some inventory that you would like to also make available for Christmas guests, right?
One of the greatest ideas, if they go to the website to buy the book, they read the book, they see the pictures, then they go to my website, they can actually order prints of those pictures.
Nice.
That's great.
Nice.
They're beautiful works, Lori. Thank you very much.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to you a few days early, but and happy holiday season to you. And again, thank you for joining us on State of the Arts. And we love the book. I've read it, and Andrew has just received a copy from Don today, so we're excited.
Thank you. It was a very pleasure meeting you on the air and being on the air and talking. I love to do that. So until next time.
Best wishes, Lori. Thank you very much.
Bye, Lori.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Lovely.
Bye.
Yes. Very nice. And how old is she? She looks maybe like really.
I cannot give a lady's
something.
Age.
She's actually 7 years old, Michael. She's
I mean,
amazing.
She's a girl.
A lot.
Very prolific.
She's middle
age.
Yeah.
Middle age actor.
All right. Well, she's lovely.
Does anyone
however
like,
old she
does
is.
Anyone like being called middle age?
No, I don't think so.
I think you're right, but I think
but
when
I
you
passed
have
it, so.
When you have the kind of talent Lori has, you take
now.
It.
Yeah.
Well, all right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to segue into her counterpart, which is our next guest. Our next guest is a Los Angeles Stage Alliance Ovation nominated actor and writer whose contributions to theater throughout the years have included 6 years as theater editor of NoHo LA, a contributor to LA Stage Magazine, not to mention his very popular website, Grigware Talks Theater, and his 7th year serving as senior live arts editor for BroadwayWorld.com, which is one of the world's, or I think is the world's largest resource for all things Broadway and theater. And he takes care of everything here in Los Angeles. He received a Broadway World Award for Excellence in 2014 as one of the top 10 regional editors across the globe. He is also an author and playwright and recently published books 1, 2, and 3 of his children's fable, which we're talking about today, Two Worlds Together, Donnelly's Greatest Christmas. Give it up for Don Grigware. Very polite audience today.
They were
lovely
gonna be,
audience.
They were going to be a little more raucous, but frankly, I couldn't find the button. So.
Don, we've had a nice conversation for television for Broadway
right,
TV
yes.
about the book when it originally came out in July, and now this is kind of the reboot of it for the holiday
right,
season.
Right.
So what inspired you to write this? What is it based on something personal? And
well, it started with 9/11 2001. I was shocked like everyone else. I sat in front of the television watching the events and becoming totally involved in the, what we call the terrorism at the time. And I sat there and I thought, can I do something constructive? Can I do something creative? Rather than just sit in front of the boob tube, you know, for 3 or 4 days. So I had this idea. I had this little story that I had used in my Spanish classes. I teach Spanish. And it was called El Reino y el Lobo, the wolf and the reindeer. And I went back to that little story, and I thought, gee, maybe I can expand this into a bigger story. And I took 3 weeks, and I did that. And it was a challenge for me because I had never written anything except for that little story about those two animals. I had never populated a whole kingdom with all of these animals, and the book is all animals. It's not, you know, human beings. So it was a challenge for me to do it, but I had an awful lot of fun doing it. And when I finished it, my little Cocker Spaniel, Merlin, had died a few years earlier, and I kept thinking, I really want to write something about him. I really loved him. He was so endearing. And it took me a year, but then I worked him into the story, and instead of having Rudolph, the reindeer, be the hero of the story, it became Donnelly was the mascot to the reindeer, so I named Merlin Donnelly, and that's how it became Two Worlds Together, Donnelly's Greatest Christmas.
Mm,
and,
that's great.
There's a lot of me in there, and the land of the holy oak. I was born in Holyoke, Massachusetts, so you can definitely hear that. There's a parallel there, and a lot of the creatures are based on people that I've known through the years. I'm in there. My dad is in there. My grandmother is in there. All my family members and a lot of the people that I've met through the years that have had a great effect on me.
So it's like Straight Up with a Twist,
right?
But in a whole other direction.
It wasn't intended that way, though. It's really about nonviolence. It's a plea for nonviolence in our world today, which I think we just don't hear enough of it. And when somebody found out that I had written the wolf as the predator, they went, oh, how terrible. We're trying to preserve the wolf. How dare you make him the villain? I said, look, read the book, because in the book, he is treated just as equally as every other animal. I do not kill him. I do not do any harm to him. And so if you get into the story, you will see that, you know, he pays for his crimes, but he is treated, you know, fairly by all of the
That's
the other,
Venomous T. Wolf.
Venomous T. Wolf, yeah, yeah.
So, Don, let's get a little plug in for where people can purchase the book, and we'll say it again before the interview is over. But
okay.
Amazon, of course.
Amazon.com, yeah. Just type in Two Worlds Together, Donnelly's Greatest Christmas, and it will come up. And it is also available in Kindle. nice price. Cheaper than the paperbacks. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice. Well,
yeah,
there
both,
you go.
Both versions.
Perfect Christmas gift.
Oh, absolutely.
Perfect time of year.
Stocking stuffers.
And it also, most important thing to me, you can actually hold this book in your hand.
Yeah, it's small. Yeah.
You know?
A good quick read. As a father, of course, I have a very high bar for what I'll read to my children. There's so much out there that doesn't appeal to children and that is really written more for the adults to have fun reading.
Right.
And that's not what's important when you're reading to your children. You want to give them the gift of imagination. And if you put them in front of the TV, you watch them zone out. But when you read to them, you see them lean forward. They're active. They're involved. What was that like starting a book?
Well, I just like Andrew, what you just said about reading to them. And I had, you know, put explicit directions at the beginning, saying this is not really a children's book, this is a family book. Mm-hmm. What I would like it to be is a story that parents will read to their kids or that older siblings will read to their younger siblings and make it sort of a family affair where they would sit in front of the fire and read a book, you know, to each other, to retell the story. Because kids love to tell stories, they really do. And there are a lot of vivid characters in there. And there's also a little space for them to pick their favorite characters at the end and color them in if they wish.
That's fantastic. Yeah, yeah, and I tell you, watching kids color is totally different from watching adults. I've watched my 7-year-old as she gets these little pictures she's working on, and it is a world of imagination. Talk about accenting the story. So that's a wonderful idea. Yeah. Really great. Yeah. Really.
Speaking
great.
Of your daughter, Andrew, you have to tell that little story that you told me last week about the driving story. It was so charming. I repeated it to a few people. I actually got that story right when I repeated it to
them. I'll give a very abbreviated version. If nothing else, this shows the boundless world that these children live in. There is absolutely no limits. And I was driving somewhere, and my little girl had just turned 7, and she'd mentioned the fact that now she thought she was ready to drive. And I said, well, sweetie, of course you don't drive until you're 16. And the look of disappointment that came over her face, that, as if I had made the rule, as if it was Daddy's fault. No, no, honey, it's not me. It's the government, people.
Right.
And she looked at me with the most earnest look, and she said, why, Daddy? And I thought, I don't really know. You're a better driver than me, I'm sure, already. So, and I watched her, and you could tell that there was just this moment of, I can do it, give me a chance. And I think that that's something that certainly in your stories you'll see. The little snippets that I read were absolutely beautiful, but it speaks to children being able to do great things, even though there's animals in the stories, which I love. And I tell you, when you see that in a 7-year-old, Michael, you look at it and you just say, man, I got to think like that every day because there's nothing I can't do in that world. Really cool thing.
Yeah. Well, as they say, the children, you know, the wonderment of children can teach us all something. So
at the end of that, she said, well, Daddy, I think I'm ready. So she's going up against the government. Child driver's license ages are dropping all over the country, I'm sure. So
stand up for what you believe in and hold on to your ideals. I mean, those are two great messages.
Very
in the book.
True. Very true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don, from the standpoint of your work as a critic here in Los Angeles of Los Angeles Theater, how do you rate where we are as a city that is a film city, really, as a town, a film town? And have we come a long way with theater, or do we still need to work on that issue? Or, and I'm sure that there's probably a lot of bad theater in Los Angeles, too, as there might be anywhere, but
I think that, you know, as a theater, it's not a theater town. And when I first came to L.A. from New York many years ago, back in the 70s, I was told by friends in New York, snobbish friends, you are going to hate L.A. You will be back here within a year. And what I found when I came here was that theater is really pretty good. There is a lot of good theater around Los Angeles, and you have to sometimes drive to find it. But it's there. I mean, I remember Uta Hagen saying once, theater is where you find it. It's not just in New York. It's in Podunk Junction, Iowa. It's everywhere. I think we have a lot of wonderful theater, and we have a lot of wonderful actors and directors who are ready. I mean, they are in a film town. They know that if a casting agent or an agent is in the audience, that they want to be hired for something. So they're usually pretty much ready for what they're doing. And I think the material sometimes falls short in the writing. Mm-hmm. That's where it falls down. But I think that as a theater town, I think we're getting up there. I really do. I think we're gaining an awful lot.
And you always, you know, I know it must be tough because I do it myself. I review theater, but not to the extent of what you do. But when you see something that doesn't strike your fancy and you always find a way to be positive about
I always say that I don't like the word critic. I mean, I'm not out to destroy. I'm out to support. And when I go to see a play, I do not read the press release before. I go in totally surprised. I want to be surprised by what I see. And people have asked me, didn't you read the press release? I go, no, I will. I want to sit and I want to enjoy what I see if I can. And 9 times out of 10, I usually do. And if there is something that I don't like, I will mention it in a constructive way. If maybe one of the performances fell short, I will say that in what way I think it could be improved or in what way the writing could be improved. I try to be as constructive and as supportive as possible in the reviews that I write because I want to support the theater. I want to see it stay alive in Los Angeles.
Well, and you were a great contributor to that. Very.
Thank you.
Very fact. And I enjoy reading your work.
I enjoy doing it. I enjoy seeing theater.
Well, thank you for spending some time with us and talking about the book. And ladies and gentlemen, one more time, Don's book available on Amazon, Two Worlds Together, Donnelly's Greatest Christmas, and also available on Kindle.
Really great reads. Thank you. Yeah, they're wonderful.
Thanks,
run out there and get it for your kids.
You're a great stocking stuffer.
Exactly.
Thank you.
All right. Andrew?
Next, we have the exceedingly good-looking Hoyt Richards. See, I was going to put that in front of mine, but then Hoyt walked in. We got all kinds of trouble today, Michael.
Yeah.
I tell you. Originally from Main Line outside Philadelphia, PA, our next guest was a scholar-athlete who graduated from Princeton, also another school that I was going to go to, but they, for some reason, wouldn't let me in. With a BA in economics, in his early career, Hoyt worked as a fashion model for Ford Models and is considered by many to be the world's first supermodel who is a male. Over his 15-year career, he was the face of numerous campaigns for fashions, top designers, and he appeared in over 300 commercials. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome Hoyt.
Michael,
excuse me.
In 2000, he moved to Los Angeles, where he began working as an actor and now has over 25 films to his credit. Expanding his skill set to include directing, screenwriting, and producing, Hoyt created his own production company, Tortoise Entertainment, in 2010. With Tortoise, Hoyt has produced 2 feature films, Dumbbells, a buddy comedy set in a gym, and I must say I saw it, hilarious, and Intersection, a romantic thriller.
Now, Michael, I'm going to talk some more. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Here we go. Thus far, these films have won over 50 awards combined on the festival circuit. Hoyt has won multiple awards for Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Screenplay. In late 2014, he joined forces with Mark Sidnota and created Dauntless Studios, which is a filmmaker-financed distribution company, and also teamed up with Sidnota as head of acquisitions for R3 International, an international sales agency.
So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the one and only good-looking, as Andrew said, Hoyt Richards.
Here, here.
All right.
Welcome back to State of the Arts, buddy.
It's nice to be here, Michael.
I tell you, man, you've had a life, brother. That is a lot of stuff.
Well, that's not even the best part. There's a whole other second life that I have that's even more interesting than that. I'll never be boring at cocktail parties.
Now, you said scholar-athlete. What sports did you play in high school?
Well, football was my favorite, but I also ran track. I was a hurdler. I played basketball, and I even picked up lacrosse at one point.
Wow.
I'm from a family that's always been very active and activity oriented. I fell in love with sports at a very, very young age. I think one of the reasons I ended up in the career that I did was as an athlete, not only did I love the team sport aspect, but I also liked playing in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
And when I couldn't really be an athlete in the same way that I used to know it, the idea of being on stage or being in a production, that was the same kind of adrenaline rush you get when you go out on the field, the same thing I get when I go on set. So I was like, this is kind of nice. This is familiar in a really great way. I think I could get into this.
I love that. I wanted to ask, you've been a very good sport about us making fun of the good-looking thing, and Lord knows that that can be a curse as well. When you walk into an audition, you're judged very quickly for positive or negative.
I just blame my parents.
But honestly, a career as a model, that's a tough gig. I mean, that's something you really have to work at to make work. How did you do that? How did you start into that?
You know, it's not rocket science from a certain point of view, so I'd say the most challenging part of it is the travel involved. And of course, I'm saying that from the point of view of being a working model. Mm-hmm. I think probably the greatest challenge is getting the work. That's the part where I feel I got very spoiled. I was kind of plucked out of you know, the crowd and anointed very early on that I could kind of compete and do well. And there was a very famous, he's still famous photographer, Bruce Weber, who kind of 3 weeks into my modeling career, I met him and he basically picked me to do a huge campaign. And before I knew it, I was going back to school for my senior year and these pictures started coming out. And I get all these phone calls saying, well, can you be in Milan next week? I'm like, well, no, I've got a test on Tuesday. I can't be in Milan. But that kind of worked to my advantage from the fact that by the time I graduated my senior year, I've been saying no so much. The fashion business loves when you're not available and they want it more. So I stepped into a pretty lucrative career right out of college. And I don't know, there's something fun about going to an Ivy League school and being told what you're supposed to do with that and then kind of going, you know what, I just think I'll be a model for a couple of years. And, you know, just kind of travel the world and hang out with the pretty girls and see what happens. And it just went a lot longer than I ever expected.
That economics degree really paid off in supermodeling, I'll bet.
Oh, the best economic decision ever made was to become a model. Now, the worst one was when I gave it to the cult, but that's a whole nother show.
Another show.
That's a whole nother show.
But you were getting, I mean, you were on the par with you know, the great models, your counterpart.
That's right. I came in with that set of girls. I met Christy Turlington at my very first Ford Christmas party. She was 14 years old.
Wow. Oh
my gosh. I think I was, 21, and she was just stunning, And so it was Christy and Naomi Campbell and Stephanie Seymour and Linda Evangelista. All those girls were just at the time that I was there. So when the girls got anointed to be the supermodel thing, that's when it all began. That's when that label really emerged as far as being a colloquial term that people used.
Now, what year are we talking about there approximately?
This would probably be the late 80s is kind of when all that started to emerge. And because they were a lot of them were dating rock stars or movie stars, and that kind of gave them a profile. But then I can say categorically, those girls were smart business people. Mm-hmm. Like, they knew about branding. They knew what they were doing, and they were great at doing it. And I just kind of jumped on their coattails from that point of view. I mean, it was one of those cases of being in the right place at the right time. Right at the point when those girls were really peaking, someone came up with the idea of, well, who's the male supermodels? And that was the point where my career was peaking, and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Well, now you touched on it earlier, and I thought it was a very interesting thing that you said about kind of how you had to transition and from sports into this world of modeling, because that is a hard thing to do, to get yourself grounded when you're in this nepotistic, kind of industry where everybody's looking at you and judging you. As an actor, I've had to take jobs as stuntman and all sort of things to make a living in this town. Did you find that team sports that you did in high school and that kind of attitude of kind of working together and growing forward and being grounded from a little bit of a Midwest upbringing, did you find that helped you in kind of taking on that new thing of being a supermodel?
Well, it did. I mean, the fashion set, meaning like the actual set that you walk onto, is very much a team. And the photographer is the director. The thing I realized, even though I was very successful, is I always felt like I was another paint in someone's painting. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really get to feel that I was so involved on the creative level other than serving someone else's creative level. And I think that's one of the reasons, even though I had this great career, I felt unsatisfied. And when I got drawn into acting and drawn to acting, it was really primarily because I wanted to not only be more involved, but that's what also created the writer in me, because I realized ultimately, if you're not a content creator, you can't really drive your career. I mean, and when I made the transition to actor, I really realized that I was coming into the game much later. Everyone was asking me, well, why did you come here 15 years ago? And I was like, well, I'm here now. Now's my time. And they were like, well, I don't know. And I realized if I don't create the opportunity for myself, no one was going to easily hand it to me. So I realized if I learned to write and tell stories that people are interested in, then I could probably start to drive my career. And then once I realized that if I start to write something and I don't have any voice,
nice timing for that. That was perfect. Well done. I don't have any voice.
I don't have any voice in the way it gets executed. That's not going to be very satisfying. Yeah. So that's when I learned how to produce. And it's just, I believe very much in, it's not either or, it's both and. So you may find your love is acting, you may find your love is writing, but don't limit yourself. What do you have to lose by learning how to produce, learning how to write, learning how to, as I'm now learning how sales and distribution, I got into that field by having movies come out that I got very disappointed about the way they penetrated or lack of penetration of the market. And I kept thinking, well, I think I could probably be as bad as the people I've been working with. Maybe there's a chance I could be better. At least I'll understand it better if I start to do it. So yeah. That's really been my journey, is to continue to grow as a creator and an artist, and just not limit myself to one scope.
Michael, I've been remarkably surprised at how many, and we think of them intuitively as very different, sports and the arts combined. And I think that it's a form of expression. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we never fund our arts in schools as well as we do our sports, but they're really two sides of the same coin. I was working with a fight choreographer just the other day who, up until he was 20 years old when he blew out his knee, was planning on playing professional soccer and then was invited to the NFL Combine, where he ran a 4.29 40, second
smokes.
Fastest, yeah, that year compared to Napoleon Kaufman. And it was amazing that he blew out his knee and nobody drafted him and his life changed and he went into fight choreography. And I watched this man take essentially his artistic skills and his athletic skills and combine them to be really a touching, emotionally driven fight choreographer who could tell a story but also had that something that made you go, wow, that's just physically very impressive. Mm. I think that's something we don't talk enough about, because there's a lot of high school athletes who don't commit to the arts because it's looked at as a yeah. stigma or something.
Well,
they're combined.
I mean, one of the greatest things about being an athlete is you're coachable.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, actors constantly block themselves by not being coachable. So as an athlete, you're used to taking input from the coach, in the same way you're used to discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of actors lack discipline a lot mm-hmm. of times. And so I think that's where an athlete has a step up of, to succeed at what they did as an athlete, they acquired certain skills that can easily be transferred to the acting field and put you ahead of a lot of the people that are trying to do it as well.
Yeah. Michael, he's smart and good-looking. I don't like
well,
him.
Well, you know, he's also a very good actor. And I must say that wholeheartedly, because he's out there winning Best Actor Awards at all these major film festivals mm-hmm. In the country. And the motion picture is Intersection, which is also winning Best Picture at all of these
amazing.
Festivals. Amazing. So how many is it now? Five, six, seven?
For Best Actor, there's about six awards. We've gotten 10 awards for Best Picture now, and more to come. I mean, it's only been the first 3 months on the circuit.
Where else do you have to? Where else are you entered in at?
Well, there's a bunch more coming up. I'm waiting to hear from. We just got into a festival in Las Vegas. We're going to be appearing. We're screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival in December.
And you had Australia calling you?
We were in the Sydney Indie Film Festival. There's one coming up in December called the U.S. Hollywood International Film Festival.
And,
wow.
So, it's I've learned as a filmmaker, it's very hard to kind of separate from the pack when you don't really have a name cast, you don't have a name director. And there's only two ways to do it, and that is an incredible festival run, which you have to be very strategic about how you do that, and that's one of the things I've been learning in this kind of recent case. And then the other thing is some sort of theatrical release. And if you don't do a theatrical release, you can't get on Rotten Tomatoes, you can't get on Apple trailers. So your best shot is going straight to VOD, and you go into that ocean of content where it's just alphabeticized, and if you're not a number or the letter A, good luck.
Every film now starts with the letter A, so people can get up to the top of that list.
Yeah, it's tough out there, and that's one of the reasons we created this Dauntless Studios was to really give the independent filmmaker a chance to separate from the pack. And obviously, the hardest part about being an independent filmmaker is you don't plan for that stage. Usually, you beg, borrow, and steal to get the movie made. I like to say, it's kind of like you put all your blood, sweat, and tears into this, and you built this incredible car, but now you have no money left over for gas, so it sits in the driveway. And you're asking for someone to come in and give you the gas and take it on the ride. And they're like, well, I don't think the car is that great. And if you want gas, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And so you get really kind of raped. And the only way to fight back is if you have some sort of money put aside, which most filmmakers don't think about. And I was guilty of the same case, and that's why as much as I try to help out filmmakers, more importantly I try to educate them, because I feel like as long as you know what you're up against and know what where you need to get to the end game, then you can think smarter from the beginning. So a lot of the films that we take on are kind of in that situation, and at that point we've entered the game where the film's completed, and there's maybe flaws, like every film has flaws. So you can't change those things, but you're limited by usually funds of how you can actually market the movie. But what I always guarantee my filmmakers is I'll say, listen, the market's going to bear it, the market's going to bear it. I can't guarantee this movie's going to succeed. I like the movie. That's why I want to work with you. I believe in you as a talent, and I want to kind of see how we can use this movie to get you into your next movie. But ultimately, how the actual sales will do, I can't control. But I can take you on a learning curve, which will make you a smarter filmmaker, and maybe we can be involved on a production level for the next project so that we can just make a smarter project that allows you to shine more brightly than maybe this project does. And that's what I try to do out there.
Now, obviously, you have your hands in a number of pies, and we're going to wrap this up here real quick. But I wanted to ask you before we let you go here, do you find yourself trying to stay away from doing writing, acting, and distribution in one film? Do you try to limit yourself, or do you like to do all the things to really be intimately involved?
I like to do it all, not from a control point of view, just because I just love filmmaking, and I love all the aspects of it. It's also sometimes been out of necessity because the honest truth is at the independent filmmaking level, usually one, maybe two people actually carry the ball. Everyone else really doesn't know what they're doing, or they're just, there's a lot of attitudes and people falter. So I've been in a couple of situations where I just had to grab the ball and take it and learn stuff that I never dreamed I'd have to learn. But I'm so grateful that I have, because it's allowed me not only to appreciate what goes on to really make a movie done, completed, but I also now can delegate and appreciate the people that you assigned that to. And it just allows me to be a lot more compassionate and a lot better storyteller and a lot better actor. Because when you know really what's involved in a whole, from a story point of view, you're not always so worried about how your line comes out. It's like, well, am I helping forward this story? How is this scene building a block so that the audience can follow what's happening? So it's not about me, it's about the story. And I think that makes you a better actor.
Well, we're better for you having done that. Thank you. Some really great films, really great pieces.
Thank you.
And one last question. How long does it take when you're going through these festivals and you're winning the accolades that you are, how long does it take to distribute that film?
Well, I like to say you want to give your film a year. To do the festival circuit. Now, if you really get hot and someone starts to, a distributor starts to come at you, well, that's great. That's obviously a good problem. But a year is usually you can do the full circuit. You can kind of get the most exposure. And the thing is, from a filmmaker point of view, your dream is to see your movie on a big screen. And usually the realistic thing for most filmmakers is the only time you're going to see it on the big screen is in a film festival, because to actually do a theatrical release is quite an undertaking and it costs money. So it's very satisfying to finally see your product up there on the big screen the way you imagined it, because the unfortunate reality is most people won't get to see it that way. They're going to see it on their TV.
But isn't that what
phone.
R3 International is?
Well, that's what we're here to help solve. But it's an education process, and most filmmakers don't understand. So it's going to take a while, but for the ones that are willing to listen and we're here to access, we can help you learn how to do it.
Well, we hope it happens. I want to see it I want to see it at the Chinese theater.
Well, it'd be great. We're going to do our best. That's all I can do, right?
Gentlemen, thank you. We have one thing that we do at the end of every show.
Now, did we tell them about this, Michael?
We did not.
See, Paul likes to tell people. I say
yes,
no, Paul.
I say
no,
no
to that
I
with
say,
your
right.
creed. Let's surprise
this is
some people.
Our kind of anointment of you, our baptism with you as guests on State of the Art. So, Hoyt has actually had the experience before. And we want you, Don, to be – we'll let Hoyt go first, but we want you to be thinking of an awkward, embarrassing moment that happened to you in theater or in film or television, anything, or even in what you do as a reviewer.
And you'll be graded on style points as well, extra points for nudity. If there's nudity involved, we always give extra credit. So,
<That's true. laughs>
Hoyt, do you have one?
Hoyt?
I've got several. One of my favorite ones was actually my second or third modeling job. I was told I was going to be doing an underwear ad for Bonjour Underwear.
There's your extra points right there.
So I'm all excited because I'm an ex-football player. I think, I'm looking pretty good. Well, I get there, and the first thing I find out is all they're shooting is my crotch. They don't care what I look like, whatever. So that's already huge blow to my ego. Then to add a little salt into the wound, the The dresser comes in there, and he basically gives me the underwear, and he's like, you know, come back when you've got them on. And I did, and he's like, okay, well, now it's time to stuff you.
Holy smokes.
And I was like, excuse me? And he's got this box of tissue. He's like, well, we got to make it all look smooth and nice. And I just sat there cringing, saying, is this really what I've gotten myself into? Is this really what I want to do? Now, luckily, there's a good ending, because I when I got on set, it was a female photographer. And the first thing she said was, oh, my God, what have you done to this guy's crotch? He looks like Long Dong Silver. So I can happily say the image that was on the back of the buses in New York City at that time was all me.
Natural one out.
Very nice.
We got rid of the tissue. And
so you should have brought your cup along with you. You'd have been in good shape. My goodness.
All right, Don Grigware.
Oh, God, I don't know why I thought of this, but this goes back many years to my teaching days. And I have, like Hoyt, I have several stories I could tell, but I was in a high school class one day, and I was a little bit angry at the students for lack of attention, among other things. And I was sitting in my chair behind my desk, and I held my hands up, and I was just about to make a point like Hitler. When my hands went up, the chair toppled over, and I went flying down onto the floor. And, of course, the class was hysterical laughing. And I think when I got up off the floor and dusted myself off, the only thing I could say was, class dismissed. What else could I say at that point? We're very embarrassing, you know. But
well,
things happen. You don't know what's going
to
happen.
And probably
right?
endeared you to your students like nothing else.
I tell you,
anytime you see your teacher as human, there's a little bit that comes back. Like, wow, that's somebody out there I need to respect. So.
Ladies and gentlemen. Gentlemen, thank you for listening this week. And once again, Don Grigware, author of Two Worlds Together, Donnelly's Greatest Christmas. It's available at Amazon.com and also with Kindle. And Hoyt Richards, who is the co-founder of Dauntless Studios and executive vice president of acquisitions for R3 International, and his film, which is making the festival circuit, Intersection, in which he stars and also has produced. So get out there, see the movies, read the books, and have a beautiful Christmas.
Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Paul, we miss you. And Michael,
yes,
thank you for your hospitality.
Yes, we do, Mr. Strolley.
Thank you to both of our guests.
Thanks, guys.
thank you. See
thank
you on
you,
the radio.
Andy. Thanks, Michael.
Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Strolley and Paul Strolley, right here on LA Talk Radio.